You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 7th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author, historian Rick Perlstein, on his new book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Also on the program today, Zephyr Teachout heads to court to fight the Cuomo challenge to her residency in New York. As if Cuomo doesn't have other things to deal with at the moment. Also in Iraq, ISIS continues its assault. Thousands of Iraqis stranded on the top of a mountain, surrounded by ISIS forces. Meanwhile, Israel worried that the Palestinians will join the International Criminal Court and asking Americans' help in fighting war crimes charges. BOFA, speaking of charges, maybe looking at a hefty fine, but will it help those people they defrauded? Edward Snowden now has 3-year residency in Russia, according to his attorney, which means he can leave and return. And Walgreens decides the tax savings involved in inversion will not be worth the price they pay with their consumers. And a new report out showing just how much unemployment insurance helped not only individuals in this country, but also our economy writ large. Ladies and gentlemen, just a little bit of house cleaning before we go to Rick Perlstein. We'll be starting a vacation. Well, I'll be starting, hopefully, on Monday. But Matt and Mike will do a Monday show live, and then we will have pre-records, mostly new material. Had a problem with some of the interviews I did at Netroots Nation. More technical issues. I've got to upgrade my... It's a long story, folks. But... We are pining for vacation here. And I think it's been about 3.5 months. And during that time, of course, I was doing double duty. So we will have, and certainly members, we will have content for every day that we are gone. We will be gone more or less live from Tuesday of next week until the following Wednesday. But again, we will have shows for you. And just a reminder, this program and any purchase of any new equipment to salvage any remote interviews is fully supported by your memberships. You can become a member at majority.fm. It's a way of supporting the show. It is really our only means of revenue. Of course, we also have our Amazon link, which you can we buy your products if you buy them from Amazon through that link at majoritireportkickback.com. But members basically make this show available to all of you every day. And as a bonus, we give an extra 50 minutes of content a day as a way of saying thank you and rewarding you. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Rick Perlstein. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the historian and author of, well, Before the Storm, about Barry Goldwater and the unmaking of the American consensus, Nixonland, the rise of a president and the fracturing of America, and his latest, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Rick Perlstein, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's a pleasure.
Rick, I let me say up front, I have yet to finish the book, but I am enjoying this. I am enjoying this so much. Because it is the era that is covered is, I think, when I was just becoming sort of conscious of of just things from 73 to 76 is covered in the book, but remembering things like wacky packages.
Yep.
And I don't. It was the wacky packages that really got me because I had totally forgotten about those.
Wacky packages have hit a sweet spot, man. Maybe some of our listeners don't know. Who's going to explain what they are?
Well, wacky packet. Well, you. Why don't you explain?
You.
They were trading cards, and they were mocking. Well, that's the thing is I don't think as a kid I had never thought about this, and that's what I hadn't really sort of why it was so great to sort of hear this thing reinterpreted in a way that I don't think I had ever interpreted. They were just basically mocking products that you would get, and it would just change the name of whatever it was, the toothpaste, and mock it. But it really was part of, and this is what. This era was about in many ways.
Yeah.
Questioning.
Challenging the pieties.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah. And not only were they trading cards, Sam, they were stickers.
Yes.
And I call them the adolescent equivalent of subway graffiti. Right. So like I quote a school teacher saying at the end of the year, she had to spend like a week just kind of scraping these things off the desks. And, you know, it's kind of like I look
guilty.
At sort of a lot of the 70s as kind of the way that the 60s insurgent energies kind of worked their way through the institutions of popular culture and all that. And that's one example. Another example is MASH. You know, like think of this TV show in which the good guy was the guy who never followed orders and hated the military and didn't think there was anything different between the South Koreans and the North Koreans. And the bad guy was the patriotic guy.
Indeed, and you know, I mean, it's interesting. I don't want to get off on too of a tangent. I wanted to start this in a different way, but I was just, I think, too overwhelmed by excitement on the wacky packages. But it was, you know, it was sort of it was the,
that's what she said.
Well, I'm a big situationist fetishist, and it occurred to me.
Yeah.
It occurred to me that in some ways the wacky packages were not unlike what was happening with the Situationist International street art, where they would reappropriate these icons in a way and deconstruct them in and of themselves in some way. But before we get there, let's start where I had planned to start, because there's I want to address this, but I want to address it very quickly because it is, I think, more than anything else, it is akin to Al Franken being sued by Bill O'Reilly. There has been an attempt by the right wing to taint your incredible. It's just an incredible achievement, this book. By claiming that you have plagiarized by restating historical facts and by a guy who is Ann Coulter's publicist, and
you can't make this stuff up,
and who you cited multiple times, but in the book, I mean, I think over 100 times, and it's already, I think, been very the charges have been thoroughly debunked. But in some ways, it's almost a metaphor for your book in some ways.
Yeah, I've become a character in my book.
Indeed. And it is, I think there's far more sensitivity because your books, your first two books were widely praised by conservatives, even in terms of capturing the rise of, or I should say, the exploitation, the rise of the conservative movement, but was an exploitation, I think, of sentiment that probably already that has existed in American politics. And I think, you know, now that you've touched upon Ronaldus Maximus, the Saint Ronald Reagan.
Right.
They're getting a little bit more upset about it. And I hope that it has done nothing more than to provide extra publicity for your book, because it's something that I think certainly is It's a great book. And let's talk about the book itself.
Yeah,
unless there's anything
quickly,
else.
You know, I mean, the best kind of summary about what's going on was by David Dayan in Salon. It came out yesterday. So, you know, just go there, you know, read his lawyer letters, read my devastating letter from my lawyers. Better yet, read the letter that he sent out to all his friends. Is actually his public relations partner sent to all his friends, asking them to join the offensive against me, saying that they can suggest tweets, that their problem is that I'm putting a new spin on Reagan. Okay, we don't have to get into details, but here's the amazing part, man. It's like I have this fantasy of advising the Obama White House and telling them how to deal with the right, and my idea is always figure out a way that every time the right says something really nasty and smearing, it boomerangs against them. So you remember that deal where, like, you know, every time someone smears you, you'll donate $100 to some worthy cause, right? So that's exactly what's happening, man. This thing has crazily boomeranged on this guy. Yesterday, my Amazon ranking was 20. There's a hashtag, Buy Invisible Bridge, that people have used to kind of, like, cite the ridiculous stuff that's coming out on the right. There's this, like, National Review piece that circulates that tells some story about from 10 years ago that I don't remember, saying I'm a lunatic and a jerk. And so one guy told me he bought 10 books just to piss off the Republicans.
Well, that's fantastic.
I'm not saying you should do that. If you do, spread them out so my Amazon ranking goes higher.
Right. And if you do buy 10, bring a hand truck because you're going to hurt yourself.
There you go.
It's a fantastic book. But
who's laughing in the background there?
I've got a couple of producers here.
I can hear it. It's bleeding through, man.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
That's cool.
They just said that's what she said. So All right. Let's start with this era of 73 and 76, and like I say, I was about 9 to 12, I guess, during that, or 7 to 10 years old during that period, and
yeah, I was born in 69.
I was vaguely conscious of a lot of the things you're talking about, but I don't think I was conscious of some of them. But this was, and you write in it, this is what I think I've enjoyed this book so much, is that this was an incredibly tumultuous period for America. Go through this list of
right.
things that took place, ranging from the terror. I mean, we had a lot of bombings. Let's start there.
That's a crazy one. There were, I think the FBI identified, it was 83 or 87, terrorist bombings in 1975 alone. And the most incredible one was in the baggage terminal at LaGuardia. The baggage claim killed like 20 or 30 people at Christmas time. I mean, this stuff was going on all the time. And kind of the context for rehearsing all these bombings is people were terrified to have public bicentennial celebrations. They were afraid that the weathermen or the Puerto Rican separatists would bomb it.
And I that's something that I just don't know that people are aware of. I mean, on some level, it harkens back to the violent the labor unrest was, 100 years ago, 80 years ago in this country. And I don't think, that people are aware. I mean, obviously people older than us are, but I certainly wasn't aware of it as a kid.
Yeah, I wrote about that a lot in The Nation last year when I was blogging, because every time there would be some hysterical thing like this, when this crazy woman crashed into the barrier at the Capitol and 200 sort of hazmat-wearing police and military personnel descended on her apartment. I made the point that when this stuff happened in the 70s, like, we didn't suspend our civil liberties. We didn't go berserk like we did now.
And it speaks to where we were as a country in terms let's talk about these other impacts before we sort of sum up the. We're talking about the return of prisoners of war from Vietnam, Watergate, the oil embargo. You mentioned that meat prices skyrocketed at one point, and I, And I
doubled in a month.
I vaguely remember that when we just chicken all of a sudden became the rage in our home.
You know, it was really funny. There was a story in the newspaper about a woman who fed her husband in it without telling him. A horse meat, and the copy editor for the book said, "Hey, I remember there was an Archie Bunker episode about that." And like, lo and behold, there it was, you know.
And we had, you know, obviously like Patty Hearst during that time. I mean, sum up the implications.
Do you want to hear my first political memory from
please.
The 70s? It was the first political argument I can ever remember participating in. And it was a very famous thing because it happened exactly a month after Nixon resigned, right? What was the famous thing that happened a month after Nixon resigned?
Was
dead air. Well, I was going to say the pardon of four, but that's not what I was talking about. In the kindergarten, we were arguing over whether Evel Knievel had intentionally pulled his parachute over the Snake River Canyon.
Right. I didn't realize that was contemporaneous at that time. So we had and the pardon obviously happened, but
a huge deal. It was really the beginning of our culture of letting elites get off scot free for the crimes they commit.
All right, right.
That's Iran-Contra. That's, you know, no bankers going to jail in the financial crisis.
Well, the interesting thing too. I mean, we raised the pardon. I want to get to that in a moment, but. But you describe, I mean, the totality of this sort of creates a moment, and I think you cite Kant at the beginning of your book in terms of what the Enlightenment was. I mean, talk about where this was in the context of where the American psyche was at this point.
That's right. Yes, Kant, his definition of the Enlightenment was. Mankind leaving its age of its enforced minority. In other words, becoming grown-ups, looking at problems in, you know, kind of serious and mature ways. And to me, you know, we remember the 70s is full of this awful stuff, but I'm very nostalgic for the fact that, like, you know, Watergate hearings got huge rankings and ratings on TV. People were sitting for hour after hour after hour watching very complex, very abstruse constitutional debates about the most important issue of power in our society. You know, we get the beginnings of the energy crisis, and people are really beginning to think hard about what it would mean to conserve energy, right? We get, you know, we lose the Vietnam War, and people are thinking hard about what it would mean for America not to be the world's policeman. This was good stuff. But one of the things I try and show in the book is it was always kind of that was where the big 70s division started coming in, and that's where kind of the wedge for Reagan to enter was people were always – there was always other voices saying, stop running America down.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I've been spending a lot of time over the past couple of years here with debating libertarians, and I mean, I don't want to be overgeneralized, but there seems to be sort of this mentality of a 17-year-old, 18-year-old goes to college, and in dealing with sort of the complexity of life, settles on sort of a fantastical set of beliefs that sort of simplify everything and answer them. And you describe a period in American culture where – in the American psyche where we are questioning the essence of America and – on some level, it's like this was a crossroads for America, whether or not we could sort of accept that we were just, you know, yes, a superpower, but with all of the shortcomings of any other society in some level. And it's sort of like it was a very raw time, it feels like, for the American psyche.
Yeah, that was the debate that was going on. I mean, that's what I was, you know, reading all these historical sources and finding, you know. There was a shouting match that broke out on the floor of the state legislature in Albany, you know, after the Vietnam War ended. one of the assemblymen wanted to have a kind of support our troops, yay America resolution. And another assemblyman said, why should we be celebrating these people who are committing war crimes? I mean, that's pretty raw stuff, you know. Jimmy Breslin, the columnist for the New York Daily News, you know, when all these POWs were coming home and they were holding this kind of patriotic festivities and having parades and, you know, giving them testimonial dinners, Jimmy Breslin said, what is this all about? This kind of reminds me of waiting for these guys to come home, reminds me of waiting for some guy I knew who was getting out of Sing Sing once. He said these guys were war criminals. They were bombing civilians. I mean, I can hardly imagine something like that, you know, the nation getting away from getting away with writing something like that, let alone a tabloid.
And so this sort of raw psyche, these ambiguities. I mean, you talk about at one point the bad news bears. In the book, and well, just tell people like what are we to garner from? And you know, we see this with all the movies out of that period, where the all these institutions are questioned. You know, like things like 3 Days of the Condor and
Parallax View,
in the Parallax View, and
All the President's Men.
All the President's Men. But even Bad News Bears, I mean, you know, the idea of Coach being just, you know, a total F-up. Exactly.
Right. And not only that, but, you know, the sponsor for the team was Chico's Bail Bonds. And it was like their slogan was Let Freedom Ring. So it was kind of like the bicentennial itself was seen as this kind of phony, kind of wacky pack scam.
And so it seems to me that when you look at your, obviously, you know, I've read so much of what you've written through the years in The Nation and every publication online. But you have talked about these divisions that have existed in America and that they have existed in America at the very least for in many respects as they exist now for the past 100 years, at least, if not longer.
Certainly since the Civil War.
And that really what we see post the Civil Rights Act is sort of a new way of formulating these divisions and a series of, you write about Goldwater and Nixon and then ultimately Reagan, that each one of these figures began to exploit these divisions in ways that built upon themselves. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, we got kind of 3 layers to the story, right? The first book about Goldwater, which, you know, culminates in the 1964 election. And Goldwater is all about this kind of mythology that if you're a capitalist and you're rich, you must have done it all yourself and that you didn't need the government, right? So that's kind of the first division, right? That, you know, between the people who, you know, are virtuous, you know, kind of paragons of the free market and kind of the moochers who use government, right? The second layer is this Nixonian layer, this kind of cultural resentment between sort of people who consider themselves the, you know, red, white, and blue silent majority who just work hard and play by the rules and don't protest and get stepped on and condescended to and smeared by these kind of know-it-all liberals and bureaucrats, right? That's Nixon land, right? And then, you know, Reagan's contribution to that is kind of dividing us. You know, and kind of these things all map onto each other, like they're overlapping, right? It's still the red state, blue state. But the division is between the people who, you know, quote, believe in American exceptionalism, right? And the people who have our vision of patriotism. I mean, you mentioned Al Franken before. He had a great line. He said, too many conservatives love their country like a child loves his mommy, right? Liberals try and love our country like adults love each other in these complex and rich negotiations, these real relationships, which I kind of somewhere in the book call a higher form of patriotism that was being sort of articulated in the 70s.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mention that because, you know, I couldn't help but feel and I am not as Lakoffian as some others, But the it really does feel, and you write about Carter too, and I want to talk about that. But there is this quality of it's almost as if, you know, we were children of divorce. You know, we had these arguing parents for a long time, and then during this period, in particular, our parents split up, and those of us who identify on the left and those who identify on the right sort of chose sides with the parents and the type of relationship that we had. You know, I'm obviously oversimplifying here, but it was as if
my parents stayed together.
Well, but how did, you know, how were, you know, we at that time, it felt like we were searching for some type of reconciliation, and it could go one way or another. It would be, one would be this sort of complicated understanding of ourselves as a country where yet we have flaws. And the other was that we are inherently flawless, and the existence of any flaws were necessarily, by definition, not part of us.
Right, right. Introduced by alien forces, introduced by the other. Right. That's Reaganism to a T. You really got the book. I mean, you really kind of boiled it down. And we know which way it went. Right. I mean, to me, you know, the book ends with the 1976 Republican convention. But the real conclusion of the book is the bicentennial, in which, you know, all the discussions of the bicentennial leading up to it. I mean, like all these newspaper editors and op-ed writers were like, do we even deserve to celebrate a national birthday party? You know, it's been such an awful time. You know, it's going to be dangerous. It's going to be hot. It's going to be sweaty, blah, 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 blah. Morose, morose, morose. And, you know, basically we planned this big birthday party, and more power to us. You know, I enjoyed it. You know, I don't think it was a bad thing.
Did you go to the train? Really, did the train come to you? I remember going on to, like, I think it was the bicentennial train that stopped.
Right. Reagan loved the bicentennial train. You know why he loved the bicentennial train? Because it was sponsored by private enterprise. So what other country could do that? Right. It's like we look at something that's like, you know, sponsored, you know, like a celebration of the country sponsored by, you know, General Dynamics, and we say, oh my God, this is awful. Reagan's like, this is so idealistic. But, you know, so the bicentennial comes and goes, and all the coverage of it is like, the keynote of the coverage is surprise. You know, that it's really kind of fun, and it isn't that hard after all to kind of have this unproblematic, knee-jerk kind of jingoistic celebration of America, right? And to me, that was a watershed moment. That was kind of like, you know, the opening curtain for Reagan's movement, you know, and then he didn't win that convention, but he obviously didn't become the nominee, but he kind of was kind of really the face of the convention, and he gave the speech that was sort of like, you know, brought, now you didn't finish this, so I'm not going to tell you. But you got to read it, because he basically does a surprise ending. Sam,
oh, believe me, I'm going on vacation. It is the I will be on this. I will find out how it ends, I guess.
But for your listeners, it's going to be a cliffhanger. Yeah.
Well,
and then I'm doing another one. I'm going to do another book that goes through 1980 and take him into the White House. And, you know, but Carter is a really complex character. I mean,
yeah,
really,
I want to get to Carter in a second. I want to get to Carter in a second because, but one thing that also stood out for me that I think really sort of exemplifies what the Reagan approach was. I mean, you cite The Exorcist in the book as
Exorcist chapter, yeah.
As,
people really like that one.
As a metaphor for what had happened to our society as it had become sort of polluted in some way. And and one thing that struck me too is that Reagan really captured this notion of it's something outside of us that comes in. That it's
right. That, exactly. Demonic forces from without, right?
And so it appears to be inside of us, but it really
right.
isn't. And
right.
it's something that can be exercised. And on some level, that's what he was offering the country, was this sort of national exorcism, rather than sort of dealing with the fact that, you know, kids are complex. It really is
right.
just all we need to do is, you know, come in, drop some holy water, and we can deal with this whole problem.
Right. Well, you know, it's not just dropping holy water. It's tradition that heals the exorcist. I mean, the movie's amazing, right? Because it's basically they try and heal her with science. It doesn't work. There's this priest who kind of doubts his faith, and he's helpless. But they bring in this super traditional priest, and he's the one who's able to do the trick. And then, you know, and it's also amazing that some people say that the character of the mother is based on Shirley MacLaine. She's this actress. She's having, like, a liberal cocktail party, all this stuff. I mean, it's remarkable how dense the symbolism is of that movie and how profoundly people react to it. It was the best-selling movie at that time. It outsold Gone with the Wind. And not only that, people reacted so strongly. I mean, they literally had, and I mean literally, they kept kitty litter in the movie theaters because that was what it took to absorb the smell of the vomit because people were so grossed out and freaked out by it because the idea of our little girls, our symbols of innocence being possessed by outside forces, whether it was cults or drugs or politics or whatever, was so close to the surface. But the last scene in the movie is amazing. Basically, the mother and her little girl are kind of like they thank the priest, and they're dressed like they're about to go to a cotillion, and it's 1962, and the 60s have never happened. And that's what was exorcised in that movie.
Is just getting rid of and really that was very prescient on some level that it picked up on what would appeal to this American psyche.
You know, the movies, art, I mean, that's how we kind of negotiate the dream life of our societies, you know.
And Reagan sort of provided that answer, and much, I think, to our detriment, and I think you, I mean, that is the argument, I think, on some level of the book, is that we were at that crossroads, and we just went down the, not only do we exercise this with, you know, some hocus pocus, but also that we choose to perceive our problems in that way.
Right. In the preface, I tell the story of the confirmation hearings of Samantha Power to be Obama's UN ambassador. And apparently 10 years ago or something like that, she wrote an article about these various kind of sins that America committed in the past that we need to kind of think through. And in her hearings, Marco Rubio, that, you know, paragon of patriotism, looks her in the eye and asks her, you know, what are these sins you're speaking of? And she responds with practically a non sequitur. She says, America's the greatest nation in the world, and it has nothing to apologize for. Well, how can we begin to address our problems if that's the way our politicians are thinking about them?
And that's really the Reagan legacy. But let's turn to Jimmy Carter, because the similarities between the way that Carter was received by liberals and with the way that Obama was, and I think to a certain extent even Clinton, frankly, were really revealing in my mind in sort of seeing that there's not much that seems to have changed in the way that the left responds to these things. Talk about that there was like almost a euphoria around Carter that
right
was largely projection.
Really, the Carter thing really, 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 really parallels the Obama thing. I mean, it's really quite uncanny. And what it illustrates is that old saying that the right falls in line, Republicans fall in line, and Democrats fall in love, right? So we want this kind of new blood, this new guy, this fresh wind. And, you know, all the basic candidates who are running for the Democratic nomination are trying to kind of draft off this kind of post-Watergate reform energy, and we're outsiders, and we're not from Washington, or, you know, something like that. And Carter is, like, just the master of this. And, you know, Carter's a pretty complex guy, right? But one thing he isn't really is a liberal. And his slogan was, "I will never lie to you." And there was a really extraordinary article that came out in Harper's early in 1976 when he was kind of like just kind of picking off primaries one by one. It was by Steve Brill, and it was called "The Pathetic Lies of Jimmy Carter." And it basically just like showed how many things he was saying that just weren't true. You know, his role in the civil rights movement, you know, the kind of reforms he made in Georgia. And it really, really reminds me of an article that Ken Silverstein did in Harper's about Obama in 2007, you know, talking about how he was in bed with, you know, agribusiness interests and all this stuff. And, you know, no one wanted to see it, right? We were so eager to have this kind of hero, this outsider who we could kind of anoint as this kind of new wind, you know? And, you know, the first thing Carter actually did when he was in the White House was, you know, he pooped on the labor movement.
Yep.
And he kind of abandoned Keynesianism by kind of cutting off all these dam projects. You know, there was all this hope when he came into office. We'd have, you know, national health care within a month because we had this, you know, colossal Democratic majority and all this stuff. You know, the New Deal agenda was finally going to be completed. But, you know, no one had given this guy a really hard look. And, you know, like I say, there were good things about him, there were bad things about him. But one thing he wasn't was what liberals thought he was. And there are plenty of liberals who didn't want to hear that.
What is it about the Democratic candidates that come in? Because I remember being in – I was in a comedy club the night that Bill Clinton won, and I was, you know, relieved, but I wasn't
– Hey, Sam, I got to go on to my next adventure.
Oh, okay.
So we got to wrap it up.
Well,
maybe one more question.
All right.
Or you can say one more nice, nice thing about my book. And
well,
say how to,
well I'll say more nice forever. Things after you go. I mean, so
okay.
So – So in the end, I mean, what when we talk about Reagan's ascendancy, what does it say about the conservative movement, I guess, in terms of is it about ideas or is it about policy or is it ultimately about a disposition?
Well, it's all of them, of course. But I think the contribution of this book is to help us understand more of the disposition, you know, this kind of blanching of complexity and this kind of instinct of kind of seeing the world in Manichaean terms, which, you know, clearly I'm seeing it in my life right now because I'm being attacked just for pointing that out.
All right. Well, Rick, we're going to have to do this again when things calm down for you in a couple, and that may not be for a couple of months. But thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. The book is great. I'll continue to talk about it after
thanks.
You go.
All I've right. just gotten such amazing support from the progressive community, and I'm so grateful. Thank
well,
you.
It's a great read. Thanks again, Rick.
Bye-bye.
And it is, folks. I mean, it really is and particularly this, the parts about Carter and the sort of we didn't even get a chance to really touch on the what seems to be the ongoing failure of the establishment media, if you will, of understanding that that politics are about differing. Sometimes rancorous opinions and this constant desire. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about Rick's with was this. It seems that Democrats have, at least since that era, following Watergate, focused almost exclusively on process as a response to the right, that it is more, you know, I won't lie to you, speaks nothing about what your politics are. There is no black, white, red America. There's no blue America. It all seems to be about process from the Democrats as a response to ideological positions taken on the right. And that is a mirroring of what we get from the establishment media, that we need to come together. And on some levels, I mean, I think I don't know what is behind that. It occurs to me that part of that is that there is a belief that the business of America is business and that the process must be right to favor business. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but it is certainly the problem that we have with Democrats today is that ultimately they are less about a belief in a certain type of politics. And it's not the case of all Democrats. And depending on what house you're in, maybe it's, you know, it's maybe it's 50-50. I mean, I recall 10 years ago saying that I thought about a third of the Democrats were corporatists. And I would say that that number is higher these days. But certainly we're seeing a growth of a populist wing of Democrats that are far more vocal, particularly in the Senate. But it is fascinating to go back and look at that era, particularly for me, because, like I say, you know, I was 7 to 10 years old and just sort of gaining consciousness. And that's the age my daughter is now. But I don't recall those bombings. I mean, if 20 people were killed today in LaGuardia Airport by a bombing at baggage claim, can you just imagine? I mean, it's stunning. And it just gives you a sense of how far this country has come. I mean, the documentary on McGovern, it's called One Bright Shining Moment, and I haven't seen it in years. But in my mind, after reading what I have read of this book so far, I've reinterpreted that period as being a period where we really were at a crossroads. I mean, if you go back and you look at everything from wacky packages to the films that were being made, the things that the people were writing, the level of protest, it was a period of time where, you know, there was almost a feeling like, you know, would we mature as a country? Which would not necessarily mean like we would get, our policies would be any better, or it would just be a capacity as a country to absorb our faults and work on them, rather than to see our faults as an existential threat, which could only be dealt with not by working through the flaws or the faults, but rather by seeing it as a cancer that needed to be rooted out. That was not, in fact, part of us. It was some outside force. And I think it's quite clear the direction that we took, because it was an easier one and a less sophisticated one. And I think at some levels, Nixon had laid the groundwork for that response with his anti-intellectualism and his emotional immaturity. And once that sort of, we were teed up in that fashion, you know, Reagan showing up, just developing his Morning in America theme, right? Where he would redeem us in some fashion. And not even redeem us, because that would involve some type of acknowledgement of lack of grace. The dynamic is different. I mean, it was interesting because when Ford pardoned Nixon, his approval ratings plummeted. So it was clear at that time the American psyche was poised to actually work through this thing. And in some way, not only did it have the implications of saying like, okay, Iran-Contra comes, we were sort of beginning this onslaught of lack of accountability for our elites, but it also denied the country the experience of going through a genuine reconciliation process, which needed to include accountability for those who had broken the law. And it really set the stage. And it also set the stage, and because the country never had that opportunity to experience the accountability of the president and those around him, you had a guy like Carter running on "I will not lie to you." Because it was no longer the process, because we no longer had faith in the process that one who lied to us would be held accountable. We needed to have a presidential candidate who would just simply, you know, swear not to lie to us. Because we no longer rely on the checks and balances that were supposed to be systemic. And you go back to Kennedy and you could see that sort of falling in love as opposed to falling in line dynamic, and FDR too, I would imagine. But nevertheless, I mean, I can't recommend the book enough, and we will post it on the blog, right? Through our Amazon link. Yes, as always. And in the post. And we'll get Rick back on in a couple months, and we'll continue this conversation.
I just think you should have done all of this without plagiarism.
Wait a second. Did you put up?
I just think you should have done all this without plagiarizing, obviously.
Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah, but you come up with 800 pages. I mean, how do you?
At a certain point.
And you start citing things like Carter won the presidency.
That
it's
really?
Like, where do you get
these
that information?
These plagiarism charges.
How could you possibly get that information?
Like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Who did
whoa.
You take that
the
from?
The sky is blue. Hold on. I think you took that from my book. Doesn't it also, you know, when I looked into Reagan a little bit before this book, even, like, one of the things that was really striking to me, too, is how his popular image is this very avuncular, sweet natured kind of guy. And not only was that not true in a policy sense, but he had a very Nixonian streak in terms of he presented it in a nicer way. But he capitalized on all of those same resentments and divisions.
I mean,
we're saying that, but
more
even
so.
Like very, maybe
more
even
so.
More
so. I think he did so.
I mean, he
far
announced,
more consciously.
Announcing his candidacy
right,
for the presidency. I mean, explain that.
Right,
that story always needs to be told.
He announced his president, and this is in 1980, I believe.
Yes.
Because he challenged Ford. He almost beat Ford for the nomination, which is a fairly big deal because Ford was a sitting president. Now, of course, he was an unelected president, so I think that mitigates that. But in 1980, or whatever it was, 79, whatever he announced. 79,
80, whatever.
He announced his candidacy in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was at a fairgrounds, which was just a couple of miles away from where three civil rights workers who had gone down there, college kids, one black guy, two white guys, went down there, and they were basically killed by some local yahoos.
They were murdered
for agitating, you know, Northerners agitating against the way that we treat our black people. And he went there and talked about states' rights, which, of course, I mean, code words makes it seem too sort of obtuse. I mean, look, the bottom line was nobody said, hey, you can't come down here. Well, no, that's not true. They did say you can't come down here and tell us how to treat our blacks. But the way that politicians would say it, they'd say the federal government can't come down here and into our state and tell us how to run things. And that's basically what Reagan talked about, was states' rights without sort of pegging it to what was the primary states' rights issue for these, you know, former Confederate states. And Reagan was very adept at this. And, you know, look, speaking of someone who was a professional actor and someone who was a professional performer, live performer, and Reagan was too, at least in his role as a spokesperson. And we didn't get into any of that. We've talked to Rick about this in the past. Reagan's relationship with
GE?
Yes, GE, but there was a specific guy, and I can't remember his name now. Who had trained him to go around and basically provide anti-union rhetoric. And, you know, you learn as an actor and as a performer, you learn to sense where your audience is. And you don't have to be in the room with them. And I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that I have skills of what we do here, that's, I think that part of that is a function of my career as a, you know, an actor and as a filmmaker, as a writer, is sort of having a sense of where the audience is and exploiting it. I mean, not necessarily being exploitive necessarily, but I'm saying understanding where people's emotions and interests lie and bringing an agenda forward that meets with those people there. I mean, you know, I've talked about this sort of very basic media training that people get. And they talk about being in the circle. It's a the state of art or a term of art. And it is, you will see this when you watch pundits go on TV. They will start by stating something that they believe will make you, the viewer, feel that they share essentially your worldview. And so it's, whatever it is. I mean, it's why they say, why the Israeli guys say all the time, like, you know, how would you react if you had to take your kids into a bunker? Or it could be as simple as something like, yeah, hey, look, you know, nobody likes to have pressure from their boss or whatever, you know, these type of things. So Reagan was very good at that. And it was an easy message for people to cling to at that point. There's a thing called growing pains. And there's a way you could deal with growing pains. One is you work through them, and the other is you figure out some way to anesthetize yourself to them. And Reagan, in some level, was a painkiller.
There was this old, and I know Carter had his own complexity, but there was this Onion headline once from one of these Onion history books, and it says, like, Carter's message for 1980 is energy efficiency and responsible leadership at home and abroad, and Reagan is kill the bastards, the flag is awesome, or something. And it's like, which message will America respond to?
Right. And I think the point is that during that period in the early 70s, there was a question as to whether it could certainly have absorbed the other. I mean, that's, you know,
right.
In a lot of European countries, I mean, it was funny because I wanted to talk to Rick about this too, but I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but when I was in third grade, which must have been around 1973 or 74, it was 75. We were learning the metric system. We were going to change to the metric system.
That's unbelievable.
There was a year or two where it was just like everything had to be metric. I mean, we were learning the metric system and we were going to join the rest of the country and the world. I mean, contemplate the implications of that. the idea that we were going to say our methodology of weighing things and measuring things, space and mass, and what we were going to, we were acquiescing, we were basically admitting they do it better in Canada and in France and everywhere else in the world. And then that went away. So I don't know.
All right. How close were we to do it? Would you say like inches or centimeters?
We were a millimeter away from adopting the metric system. I mean, we had to get new rulers. People were starting to convert their wrenches. I don't really remember. You know, that would actually be a great guest. We can find a guest who wrote about that era of like what happened. I for the life of me, I can't tell you what happened. It was just all of a sudden we were gone to, and then show up in September one year, and just people just didn't talk about it.
Reagan anymore. Showed up.
I don't know if that's
everybody
what Reagan
watched.
Showed. I don't remember the timing.
Kidding.
I remember in elementary school, early elementary school, before fifth or sixth grade, I believe. I don't know. Maybe it was fifth or sixth grade. I can't remember. But I remember doing a science project. It was a piece of cardboard, you know, paper. It was purple, and I think I had cut out like a George Washington in an arm. And it was like, in a big X through the arm, showing we're not going to do feet anymore or whatever. I can't remember. But all right, folks, let's save this stuff for the better half. We have really given a bonus to our freebies today. A reminder, we rely on members for 100% of our revenue. Not 100, 99.9.
And only just that.
98.
We just gave you a little sample of what goes on in the members' half. If you enjoyed that conversation, that's what happens in the members.
Yeah,
more.
We talk about the metric system every day of the week.
I mean,
every day of the week.
Conversation.
All right, so become a member today, folks. We really could use your support. And like, you know, we've been hinting at, we're developing. One of the things that, you know, after vacation when we get back, I want to do is we're going to try and move the office. We're going to try and get a bigger space. We're going to try and perhaps create some other shows. We're going to try and provide more video offerings. We're going to try and develop a way of regularly and efficiently and as inexpensively as possible providing transcripts for our interviews with the hopes that they will spread further and wider. We got a whole set of plans, but I think we're going to probably try and do a fundraiser. But knowing that we're going into this with a certain amount of memberships that we can count on is, the way to make sure that I get sleep at night, basically, is what it comes down to. So become a member today at majority.fm if you enjoy the program on a daily basis. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Majority Report Kickback. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Buy all your Amazon junk. There. We get a kickback. Sorry. I fell asleep for a minute. You want to be a part of the program? 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. Get the app, majorityapp.com. Android or iOS. Over 6,000 of you have downloaded the app. I know there's a lot more of you out there with smartphones. It's a great way to turn people onto the show. And we're going to try, you know, one of the things that we're going to try and do is try and orient even more towards mobile, allowing mobile sharing and other goodies down the road. We've got a big list of things we want to do. But all that and more. So give us a call, 646-257-3920. I am me at Majority FM. We'll be right back.